Welcome back. We are delighted that Jerry Adams is our guest. Bill Russell?
You use in the book two words, that one of which is unfamiliar and the other is increasingly familiar, the notion of a securocrat. I'd sort of like to explore, because it seems to be at the center of a lot of the challenges in Ireland and increasingly around the world. And the other is terrorist, which has become a word that is used more often than sometimes seems appropriate. And you point out that at one point Margaret Thatcher refused to meet Nelson Mandela because he was a terrorist.
Or at least she said that.
Well, that was her assertion and perhaps her view. And they're only words, but you know, the words sort of inform the world that we inhabit. They tend to define the way we see things around us. And part of the charm of your book is how complex things are, that it's not quite as simple as the nightly news might want you to believe. But I'd like to, if you don't mind, sort of work our way through the notion of securocrat and the notion of terrorist.
Well, one person's securocrat is another person's terrorist. That's the rub of it. The word securocrat, interestingly enough, comes from South Africa. It's a mixture of security and bureaucrat. And we use it, as I think they used it in that country, to describe those faceless people who actually have responsibility for your life and liberty, or in our context, for our lives and liberties.
It's the institutionalization of a security apparatus.
It's actually, you could talk for hours in this, because what the British did was, they did this in other conflict situations. They did it in Kenya, they did it in Palestine, they did it in Cyprus. Most famously under the tutelage of a man called, I can't remember his name, he wrote a book called, Kitson. He wrote a book called Low Intensity Operations. Yeah. And what he argued for was that there had to be an integrated approach, that all of the state's resources and institutions had to be all geared to defeating the insurrectionists. And that the law, he wrote, was to be used as a tool for the disposal of unwanted members of the public. So
that seems like a deep perversion of our sense of law and justice.
But that's the reality, and it's there. And under some Labour governments, and particularly under Thatcher, that was given carte blanche permission to do what it wanted. So that you have a situation, for example, in the period I write about, and I was victim of this, that you could be arrested and interned without trial, just whipped off, and that's it. You were imprisoned. Your house could be raided, your house could be searched, items could be taken from your home, your car. You could be stopped at any point. Your home could be confiscated. A whole range of measures could be taken against you. Inquests could be stopped, and are. There's still battles going on at the moment to have inquests into the deaths of people which occurred some time ago. So the part of the problem, and you're very insightful when you say this, part of the problem at the moment, I think, lies with the reality that the securocrats still retain a hold. And I think it's human nature. If people are in positions of power, they're unlikely to give it up easily. So from the securocrat point of view, what has happened since in the Irish peace process is unthinkable. That Sinn Féin would now be in a position of the largest nationalist party in the north, that we would have by mandate the right to be the deputy first minister and the other ministers, that, for example, Martin McGuinness would be the Sinn Féin minister of education and Barbara de Bruin the Sinn Féin minister of health, that the likes of me can even the fact that I could write a book and people might read it, would be absolutely, you know, will keep many, many securocrats awake at night worrying about all of this.
But it seems, you know, part of the lesson, it would seem, from what you're describing is we should be very, 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 very careful before we establish that kind of security apparatus
I think obviously any country has the right to defend itself. And there is a reality that a government may have to take up measures at different times because the country or the citizens are under threat. But, you know, human beings are very corruptible and there needs to be plenty of safeguards. And I think, you know, the things that I've come to learn about America are things which I value. I think that the notion of a rights-centred society, the notion of a republic, the fact that you have a Bill of Rights and so on, that you have transparency, that you have the right to information, that there is an election-based democracy. You know, at all levels, people go forward for public office. And, you know, I mean, the elections in the north of Ireland were cancelled twice in the last year by the British government. That would be just inconceivable to an American citizen, whether they vote or not. They just couldn't imagine anybody suggesting that there wouldn't be an election, or indeed that the institutions of government would be suspended, would be just outside the experience. So there are lots of things, and in our situation, which is interesting, it doesn't just affect what happens in our country. It affects the British government and what happens in its country. And in many ways, they will be more victims of it than we, because we are the people against whom it's been imposed. So we will be against it, and we will look for better ways of doing it if we were sovereign and in our own place. Whereas in terms of Britain, all of these things are now becoming part and parcel of life there.
Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King, we sit here in Atlanta, where his bones rest. He always used to say, until everyone is free, no one is free. And it seems that that's some of what you're saying.
Yes, I think that, you know, there are lots of Irish ways of saying that. I think Martin Luther King expresses a universal truth. There's always someone who needs the help, the safeguards, the protections, the liberating influences. And while there's any one person unfree, all of us are unfree. I mean, why are you interested in Ireland? I mean, you know, sure, I mean, you have, I presume, a relatively comfortable existence here, but yet you're interested in what's happening, which I think is one of the great things about humanity. It's one of the great things which brings me back and forth. Why am I interested in what happens in the Middle East? Why do I worry? I mightn't do an awful lot about it, but why do I worry about the fact that people in the third world don't get enough malnutrition? And it brings home to me the fact that I think that people essentially, this might seem naive, but I think that people essentially are good. I think essentially most human beings want to do good, or at least don't want to do bad, and if given the chance, would be able to create a far, far better place for all of us. People aren't born racists. They aren't born as bigots. We're taught that.
Justice would seem to be a big piece of this. Paula quoted Dr. King, quoting the Old Testament about justice rolling down like a river, but she quoted it to Alan Dershowitz, who had written a book on the origins of justice, and he said, you know, I have the highest regard for Dr. King, but I don't think that's the way it works. Justice is a constant struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't achieve a state of justice and expect to live happily ever after. It's not like nirvana, and that's certainly... And I won't say that you've achieved a state of justice, but it's certainly that ongoing struggle seems to be integral to essentially your adult life and that of the people with whom you've been working.
Well, I went into the Jimmy Carter Center here in Atlanta, and it's quite remarkable that this city has two Nobel Peace Prize winners, both Martin Luther King and Jimmy Carter. And on the wall is this little sentence, so self-evident, peace is not just the absence of conflict. I remember writing something similar to that. Obviously, I read it somewhere else. You know, probably if you go back to Aristotle, you'll find that someone... So all of these are journeys and are processes. You can't live on eating bread. You know, you have to keep moving at it. You have to keep working at it. And I also think, for what it's worth, that it's what makes life interesting. You know, perhaps at some point in my life, I would like to do nothing. But I do think that it is what listening to other people's views on this, trying to get into other people's shoes, being able to tell of your own experiences, and also some sort of a sense that life is unfair, and that's the way it is. There's no point pretending life is unfair. I consider myself to be very, very lucky. So therefore, as one of the lucky ones, I have to try and use my life to make life slightly fairer for others who mightn't have the same chances, or if not to make life fairer, to make them more able to deal with the unfairness in life. And I don't want to be too pious about any of this, but I think that's essentially what it's about. And those who live in more developed parts of the world, I think, have a duty. It's a matter of our soul having a duty to try and highlight or to shine a light or to in some way improve the situation of other people.
The person who has spent his life doing that is Jerry Adams. He has written A Farther Shore about, as he uses the subtitle, Ireland's Long Road to Peace. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is here, as we are both with Jerry Adams. We hope you'll be with us when we return.